May it please the court. The case law is clear that in order to invoke the Fifth Amendment, right to counsel, a defendant must actively invoke that right by actually requesting an attorney. And this request must objectively be unambiguous. So with these concepts in mind, the statement, "I'm not signing anything without an attorney," cannot be objectively interpreted as an unambiguous and affirmative request for an attorney for all purposes. The plain words of this specific statement are clear, and a reasonable police officer would understand only that the defendant wanted an attorney before signing.
Is it relevant that he didn't just ask that question out of the blue? If I understand it, he read his Miranda rights, then said, "Will you sign this waiver?" And he said, "I'm not signing anything without my attorney," not quite using his vernacular.
Right.
But so in the context of it, and then the officer stopped asking questions.
So the context is important, but what the context actually is you stated that the officer stopped asking questions, but the officer had never been asking questions. The officers were transporting the defendant to the hospital to get treatment for his gunshot wound. This was not an interrogation. They were not asking him questions. He, on his own accord, voluntarily started making statements, and the police, wanting to be conservative, wanting to ensure that the defendant understood his rights, just preemptively gave the defendant the Miranda warnings.
Now, is this a fact issue that the trial court decided that after hearing all the evidence, the trial court made the determination that that statement was made and it was a waiver of his, it was an invocation of his Fifth Amendment rights? So how can we go against the fact determination by the trial court?
So the factual issues in this case are what the defendant said, you know, the specific phrasing of his invocation, limited invocation, the context within which it was made, the timing of it. But the legal effect of that statement is a legal conclusion that this court would review de novo.
But the trial court found in the context that it was made in response to the request for statements.
So the trial court did state that the defendant had been read the Miranda warnings, but it also stated that the defendant had been asked to sign the consent to search form, and that it was in response to this ambiguous combination of these that
he actually found it was unambiguous, though, the trial court, in context. I mean, I saw him use that word, and he said he thought it was an unambiguous invocation.
Well, the exact language in the trial court's order is that colloquially, the defendant more likely was indicating that he would want an attorney for all purposes. But this is an incorrect legal standard. The United States Supreme Court was very clear in that, quote, "the likelihood that a suspect would wish counsel to be present is not the test for applicability of Edwards." That's Davis versus United States. That court went on to also say that if a suspect words are understood only that the suspect might be invoking the right to counsel, then that's not enough.
What's the significance in our decision of the burden of proof? Because you have a statement that I know that the trial court found it was unambiguous, but if this court finds it's ambiguous, you have the burden in the motion to suppress. So if the statement could be interpreted either way, and the trial court interpreted it one way, how do you meet your burden? Is it because you think it has to be unequivocal, or I mean, because the trial court found it means one thing and wasn't unequivocal?
So the meaning of the defendant's statement is really the only legal question that is before this court. If we were to say that that was a factual issue that the trial court found that this court would defer to, then there would literally be no legal issue before this court on appeal. And so, right, whether that statement was ambiguous, what the meaning of it was, is a legal conclusion that this court would review de novo.
But the facts as to the circumstances of it and the context of it that Judge Stith was mentioning, those factual determinations inform what the meaning of the statement is. Yet you're taking just the statement, aren't you? As your legal conclusion.
I think it's important to note that the context with which it was made, the context that I've laid out in my brief, was not contrary to anything that the trial court found. The trial court's factual findings and frankly, the trial court did not make detailed factual findings. It simply said that, you know.
And it doesn't have to. We would find then all the facts in the light most favorable to the trial court's ruling.
That's correct.
Was this based on stipulated facts or not?
Yes, Your Honor. And the trial court's order and page 1 specifically states, quote, the motion was heard on stipulated facts.
And then
period.
It says the courts reviewed the exhibits submitted in support, the suggestions in support, and the suggestions in opposition and reviewed all the cases. So it went beyond the stipulation, which was an oral one, not a written one, if I understand.
It was an oral stipulation.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
I couldn't find it in the record. But they also reviewed other things. And it wasn't just on the stipulation, is my point, as I read it. It was the stipulation plus the exhibits.
That's true.
What were the written exhibits in addition to the stipulation?
The written exhibits were, my understanding is, deposition testimony of one or two of the officers, as well as one of the officers' police reports. But the facts that were actually stipulated are the four facts, essentially, that I pointed out in my brief, that the defendant was given the Miranda warnings, that the defendant and the officers then continued to speak for some indeterminate amount of time, and then the defendant was asked to sign the consent to search form, and then the defendant immediately asked or stated that he wouldn't sign anything without an attorney. Now, those four facts, and those are the operative facts, anything in the exhibits, anything else that was not a fact directly stipulated to, essentially are secondary to what the defendant actually stipulated to. And so those facts, because those essential dispositive facts were stipulated to, then this court can rely on those facts.
Can you address, if you look at the cases, they're a little, not quite inconsistent, but lead in different ways. They say you broadly interpret the request for an attorney, but they also say it has to be an unambiguous, it can't be a tentative request. But looking at the cases, it's where the defendant says, maybe I should have counsel, or gosh, do you think I should have counsel, or something where they're tentative in their request for counsel. And then there's other cases where there's a limited waiver, but the court said that you have to, if you say, okay, I won't sign anything, but I will talk to you, you have to affirmatively indicate, I'm only waiving here, I'm not waiving this other part of it. And all the cases I could find that I looked at where they said, okay, you refused to sign anything, as you did here, but you didn't waive, you didn't invoke Miranda for oral statements. There was an affirmative indication by the defendant, but I'll talk to you. And there was this distinction. And here, all we have is after the Miranda, and then after his saying, will you sign this? And he says, I'm not doing it. He didn't do that affirmative indication, but I will talk, which all the cases I found had, where it was this kind of situation where it wasn't tentative, it was a solid statement, I won't do something.
That's right. So in this specific case, the defendant did not give an affirmative statement that he was willing to speak outside of signing things. In my brief, I believe it's my reply brief, I lay out, I believe, five or so cases across jurisdictions, a Sixth or Seventh Circuit case, Georgia Supreme Court case, where they held a limited invocation despite the fact that the defendant never affirmatively stated that he was willing to speak. And that has to be right, because told otherwise that the defendant has to actively, affirmatively state that he's willing to speak outside of the limited context of his limited invocation, that would be exactly backwards of the case law, the principles in the case law.
Of the fact that he was Mirandized the next day and chose to speak rather than write something. In other words, you have a second Miranda here, right?
He was Mirandized the next morning by separate detectives.
At that point, he chose to talk, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That is when he effectively, right, made his confession or whatever that is that he told the detectives.
But the problem with that is that if he invoked his rights the day before, they had no right to come in and ask him again without his counsel present. The cases are clear that if the first day it was an invocation of his right to counsel, they could not come back in without counsel present and ask and give Miranda again and ask him to waive.
If the first statement was a full invocation.
If the first one was, exactly.
The question is whether it was a full invocation or not,
right.
Whether it was selected.
Right.
Correct. But as far as him being re-Mirandized a second time the next morning, that just goes to show that the police officers were trying to be conservative and make sure that his right to choose between speech and silence did remain unfettered.
But that was illegal if the first one was a complete invocation. That wasn't being conservative. That was violating the Supreme Court if, and there's an if, the first day was sufficient to invoke his rights. They could not do that. That's specifically barred by the cases.
If it was a full invocation, that's correct. But because an invocation has to be unambiguous, affirmative, and objective based on a reasonable police officer's interpretation, then the police were well within their rights to say, you know, the statement, I'm not signing anything without an attorney, well, we are going to honor that. And the trial court made a specific finding that the officers didn't ask him anything beyond there in the ambulance after he had stated that he wasn't going to sign anything.
Was he handcuffed at that time?
He was handcuffed in the ambulance, yes. Essentially, though, the purpose of Miranda is to give a defendant the choice between speech and silence. Defendant was given that choice numerous times here, and he understood that choice, and he chose to speak. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. It seems to me that the issues before the court this morning are twofold.
And you need to speak up a little bit.
I beg your pardon, ma'am. The issues before the court are twofold. The state acknowledges that the standard of review is one of deference to the trial court, then attacks the trial court's decision and suggests why it is incorrect. What I think the court ought to focus on are the facts that Judge Goodman was looking at, and those are many. They were beyond just something of a simple statement that's sort of given in a vacuum. Mr. Holman had dialed 911. Judge Goodman knew that. Mr. Holman was administering CPR when the officers got there. Judge Holman knew that. The officers were told to come in. They immediately secured the scene, and in part of doing that, they immediately secured him in handcuffs. They took him from a bedroom into a living area, immediately handcuffed him, and then removed him from the home. One officer continued with CPR, discovered that Ms. Holman had expired, and then he left the premises. The other officer was taping the scene and making sure that nobody went back in. They had taken Mr. Holman to a patrol car and placed him in a patrol car. There is a tremendous amount of snow on the ground. It has taken the officers about an hour to get there because it's in the middle of a snowstorm. Mr. Holman has dialed 911 many, many times, and they've called back because if he's out in a remote area, they never actually connect with him and understand what is being said. They don't know what's going on inside the building when they get there. Mr. Holman has been shot. He tells them that, but they observe no injuries on him, and so they don't quite believe him. So that causes him a little bit more distress. He's placed in a patrol car because he doesn't have any clothing on. He's wearing clothes, but he's not geared for the weather, and he's left there alone, and then another officer comes and gets him and puts him in an ambulance. The ambulance EMTs believe that he had non-life-threatening injuries, so they went to check on his wife, discovered she had expired, and then came back and treated him. So there was this interchange going on with Deputy Thorne inside the ambulance when Deputy DeVoe came up and saw them speaking. Mr. Holman was in distress and was complaining to them that he believed that they were not treating his wife, and he was starting to say things that Deputy DeVoe believed were incriminating in some way and believe that it was appropriate to advise him of his rights per Miranda. Deputy DeVoe had testified in deposition, which the deposition in its entirety was provided to Judge Goodman, that he had called his mentor on the way there and said, when you believe it's appropriate, Mirandize him. It's going to be a murder scene, so do everything by the book. So he believed it was appropriate at that point. So at this point, you have an individual who's in distress because he knows he shot his wife. He knows he's been shot. He knows he's now being handcuffed and being asked to do things by law enforcement personnel. Upon the recitation of his rights per Miranda, he immediately invokes his right to counsel by saying, I ain't signing blank without an attorney. Now, I don't know how you can be more emphatic and unequivocal in saying that you want the presence of an attorney in moving forward with the officers when they're asking you to do something specific.
The officer asked him to sign something, and his response was to specifically to whether or not he was going to sign the consent to search. The difference is saying, I want an attorney, as opposed to I'm not signing anything without an attorney. Isn't that a distinction?
I recognize that premise, Your Honor, and I guess my response would be that Judge Goodman focused on Edwards versus Arizona, where it's a pretty emphatic statement from the Supreme Court of the United States that says, if an individual indicates his unwillingness to move forward without the presence of counsel, then the questioning must cease. And I think that's what Judge Goodman focused on, recognizing that is this statement from him immediately upon hearing the question, which was immediately upon the recitation of his rights per Miranda, that was a pretty strong indication that he was unwilling to move forward without the presence of counsel.
How do we deal with the issue of objective indicia of there has to be an unequivocal invocation of the right to counsel so that police on the scene know how to respond, know if it's been invoked or not when he used that particular language? Is there a tension there, and how do we, and was it up to Judge Goodman to resolve it, or is it, like opposing counsel says, a question of law for the court?
I think the case law would direct you to Connecticut versus Barrett, and it would say, is there some indication, if you believe that the statement, as emphatic as it is, I'm not doing this, you look to Deputy DeVoe, who stopped questioning him, whether he believed it was appropriate or inappropriate, that fact remains that he immediately stopped questioning him. Deputy Thorne never questioned him. Deputy DeVoe went and told four different detectives on scene that he had said this, so there was no questioning of him on scene. He was taken to a hospital, treated, and then removed from the hospital, taken back to the jail. About 12 hours later, someone removed him from the cell, advised him of his rights per Miranda, but suggested to him, hey, we have some questions for you about, we need to get your side of this story, see where things were. And the questions that the statements that he made have to do with where he's standing in the room. Now, it was presented to him in a way that I believe, you know, tell us what occurred here, that, you know, this may be much ado about nothing. He believed he had engaged in self-defense and had shot after he was shot. Most people are going to believe that, well, if I tell the police exactly what occurred to me in these circumstances, they'll understand that I'm in a reasonable setting and they'll let me go.
And that's okay, and that's a waiver if you know.
I understand, ma'am, but his first statement was, I want an attorney. Now, if it was only to sign this form, he could have said something beyond that and indicated to them, I'm willing to talk to you and make you understand what it is that I think occurred here, but he didn't say something like that.
How much time elapsed between when he said, I'm not signing anything, until he did talk?
In the transcript at page 20, Judge Goodman asks that question of both counsel, and we both agree that it was an immediate response, and that was based upon Deputy DeVoe's deposition testimony.
But how long till the next day? It was the next day when they asked him again and he did talk?
Yes, ma'am.
That was the question.
I beg your pardon. The question was presented to him on scene at about 12:58 a.m., mm-hmm. and he was interrogated the following day at about 11:30 a.m. So
you say the statement about not signing was immediate after Miranda, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, if I understand it, there had to have been some intervening time because the subject changed from Miranda to consent to search.
It was a question presented by Deputy DeVoe, and Deputy DeVoe had testified in his deposition that as soon as he had advised him of his rights per Miranda, he had requested a consent to search form so that they could process the scene.
Now, but he wasn't being asked to sign an acknowledgement and waiver of his Miranda rights.
No, sir.
That's a pretty clear change of subject, if not, expanse of time.
He was never asked to sign a waiver of Miranda, even while he was being interrogated the following morning. I don't know that that's dispositive to anything, but Lawrence County didn't do such a form. I think also we keep looking at this as a stipulation of facts. It's not. There were people subpoenaed to this hearing, and they bothered not to show. They were the detectives, Deputy DeVoe. We were about 20 days from trial, so we were sort of put in a circumstance of wasting our time or trying to submit these facts to the court saying this is what they would testify about had they showed. All these people had been deposed about 20 days before this event. What we were suggesting to the court is if they had appeared, this is what they would be testifying about. Now, if I'm the person who made that mistake by saying this is a stipulation of what they're going to testify about, I was not suggesting to the court that he has to accept every premise that we present as it is a fact, we stipulate to it, and you must accept it. I don't think Judge Goodman would have appreciated that. I think he would have said, I can disregard any testimony that I choose.
Well, he did say the motion was heard on stipulated facts, and then that he also had reviewed the exhibits. And
the exhibits were, again, Detective Melinda McElroy's deposition, complete deposition.
Do you perceive it as a contested hearing where there were certain facts stipulated to,
right,
and then additional testimony submitted by way of deposition?
Yes, Your Honor.
But and ultimately, the question was, did he make, by action or words, an objectively unambiguous invocation of his rights? That's what the judge had to decide.
Correct.
And is that a question of fact or law?
I think it is a question of fact in this circumstance because of the context you have to place it in. If the context of this is he's sitting in a interview room at the Lawrence County Jail, and they come in and say, hey, we need you to sign this consent to search form, and he says it there, then it would be in that context probably not an invocation of his right to counsel. He doesn't have all those other stressors going on. But when he's standing in the snow,
right,
handcuffed, and in his mind, he's called the police and said, come here, I've been shot. Again, there's many, many phone calls, but he's communicating, I've been a victim of a crime, and I responded, and now he's immediately arrested. That's a pretty antagonistic event.
I think you misunderstood me, or I missed.
I beg your pardon, Judge.
I misled you. I wasn't suggesting the trial court was wrong. I was just trying to distinguish between what part of the trial judge's analysis gets deference and what part doesn't.
In Edwards itself, the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, looked at the context and talked about the fact that interrogation ceased once the person invoked the right to counsel, and looked at how they interpreted the invocation at that time. So it's sort of, they say it's an objective standard, and yet they look at it in the context. So it's not that it's just the words. You look at the words in context.
And frankly, I think Connecticut bears that premise out, ma'am. It comes along later and says if there is an equivocal or some statement that a objective person may think is ambiguous, has there been something else presented that says, yes, I'll move forward in a different way? The Southern District had suggested that Connecticut versus Barrett didn't really hold for that, but it seemed to me that was an inference that you could not ignore, that somebody has to say something beyond a statement that I won't do something, but I will do something else. There has to be some indication to the police that there's a willingness to move forward in some measure. Otherwise, the police are sort of guessing as to what it is. But once he has said so emphatically again, And some people may find it rude in the way that he communicated it to them. But I think that it's indicative of his feeling at that point in time that says, gee whiz, I call you guys about what's going on here, and you arrest me. You don't believe that I've been shot. I mean, they actually said that to him. We didn't find anything on him that indicated he'd been shot, and they stuck him in a police car instead of an ambulance. At this point in time, his agitation is something that Deputy DeVoe found concerning, and that's why he advised him of his rights per Miranda. Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
So if I understood counsel correctly, he's conceded that the stipulated facts, the recitation of facts, was a stipulation of facts, and that in addition to that, the party stipulated to these exhibits, the trial court reviewed these separate exhibits also. But the case law indicates...
He stated that he stipulated that that's what witnesses would testify. Is that different from stipulating to those facts being true?
It is different. Stipulated facts are just that. They are the facts that have been laid out in historical order.
What does the record show here that was stipulated to? Facts being true facts, or that this is what the witnesses would testify to?
True facts. The in the transcript, page 2, the prosecutor and I can agree on most of the facts, and then the question will become, what is operative law vis-a-vis these facts? And if you will permit me, I will recite what I think the facts would be. That was from the defense counsel, and then the defense counsel recited the facts, and then immediately after, the prosecutor said, yeah, as far as the facts, I think you did a very good job on that. And so the case law indicates that once you have stipulated facts, then there's no deference due to the trial court because there was no finding of fact, it was just stipulated facts, and so it then becomes just an issue of law. And so the stipulated facts, as I laid out in my brief, are that the defendant was read the Miranda warnings, there was some conversation for an indeterminate amount of time, and then the subject did change from the Fifth Amendment topic of the Miranda warnings to the Fourth Amendment, can we search your home, the request for the consent to search form, and then the defendant, in response to that Fourth Amendment search request, stated, I'm not signing anything without an attorney. Counsel stated that the trial court's ruling was focused on that, you know, whether the defendant indicated an unwillingness to proceed without an attorney. And as I stated when I was up here first, that's the trial court's approach was simply a misstatement of the operative law, and that an indication cannot be implied. It just can't. If a defendant indicates some unwillingness and it's ambiguous, if it's implied, it's just not enough. An indication has to be clear, has to be objective, unambiguous, and a defendant has to actively, affirmatively request counsel.
In deciding whether it's objectively unambiguous, though, it was the trial court entitled to consider that the officers actually there reacted as if they thought he had invoked his right to remain silent?
The officers did not objectively.
Well, they did not begin questioning him as though he had waived his Miranda rights. They didn't articulate why, but you could look at it objectively and say they seemed to have understood that he was not willing to be to proceed in his interaction with the police without counsel.
The officers were not questioning him to begin with, and so...
Did they go then get a warrant for the scene?
I'm sorry?
They asked him to sign a consent to search. He said, I won't sign anything with a lawyer. Did they then proceed to get a warrant to search the scene?
I'm not sure. But as far as having been... after the defendant made his statement, the officers were not questioning him before, and so they didn't begin questioning. Questioning began roughly 11 hours later by completely separate detectives who presumably were in charge of questioning the defendant.
Did he stop talking about the incident after that?
I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure the record is clear. Thank you.
Any other questions? Case will be submitted.
I just wanted to say that was a tough first argument under fire, and I appreciate your poise and both counsel's knowledge of the facts and the law was really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.